CBSSports.com NBA podcast, everyone. I'm your host, Matt Moore. This is the Knicks and Nets offseason review. We've decided to combine the two as kind of a look at the New York landscape in terms of pro basketball. We'll be talking about the rivalry, both teams' offseasons, their additions, and you know what this is going to look like as pro basketball moves into a new era in New York. You know, maybe no team has had a more tumultuous offseason than the New York Knicks. Even with all the additions that they made with Marcus Camby and adding Raymond Felton and Jason Kidd, losing Jeremy Lin really changed the landscape of pro basketball in New York and created a divide among Knicks fans. So that's where we're going to start. We bring in Ken Berger of CBSSports.com, NBA senior writer. Ken, you know, we'll get to Lin later on in this podcast. I want to know from you, you know, if we look at all the other additions that they made, did this team move forward, or are they pretty much the same team that they were last year, or did they take a step back?
No, I think they have taken a step forward. I think just by virtue of the fact that this will be a full training camp and a full 82-game season, you know, with Carmelo operating in an offense that he's comfortable in, and, you know, with some significant help, you know, albeit from aging veterans, you know, the likes of Jason Kidd and Marcus Camby. But I think, you know, that veteran leadership, I think them getting stronger around the basket defensively, with Tyson Chandler having a tendency to get into foul trouble, that, you know, you can rely on Camby to give you solid minutes in that defensive stopper role at the, you know, as the backbone of the defense. And, you know, Jason Kidd is, you know, he's going to close games for you, and he's going to do it in a smart way. And, you know, let's not forget, he can also shoot the three a little bit as well. So, you know, I think all in all, I think this is a better Knicks team than the one that lost in the playoffs a few months ago. And, you know, the question is going to be how much better, because everybody else around them, including their, you know, crosstown rival, who's, you know, the Nets, which are now closer than ever, have gotten better as well.
Do you feel like, you know, my thought is they definitely, I look at the additions that they made, and while Felton, I think, was developing a good chemistry with Stoudemire on the pick and roll before he was traded, other than that, to me, every indication, including the, you know, the removal of the interim tag from Mike Woodson and signing him as the actual head coach, everything indicates to me that they are full in with Stout, with a Melo as kind of, you know, number one. A lot of these superstar teams, the concept is, you know, supposed to have multiple stars on equal levels. I mean, with the Heat, obviously, you know, LeBron has stepped forward and he's that guy. He's the number one, and even Wade is definitely the number two now. Are we seeing kind of the same thing in New York where, you know, whether it's the injuries or just the style or CAA's commitment to Carmelo or whatever, do we see that really the Knicks are establishing Melo is the number one and Stoudemire is the clear number two and on down the line?
Oh, there's no question about that. I mean, as soon as the Knicks gave up all that they gave up, which was a tremendous amount, to get Carmelo and give him that max extension, that writing was on the wall. And, you know, if not for the emergence of Jeremy Lin, you know, saving Mike D'Antoni's job there for a few weeks, he would have been gone long before he resigned in March. So, you know, they are all in with Melo. And I think, you know, watching Team USA this summer, it's a different dynamic, obviously. Melo had to accept a bench role, which clearly he's not going to do on any NBA team he plays for. But I saw some positive things. You know, I saw him, you know, committed and locked in on the defensive end. I saw him rebound the ball. I saw him, you know, when he does post up, he's posting up closer to the basket as opposed to way out on the three-point line, where he's always been accustomed to doing it. And, you know, that isolation game of his where he posts up so far out on the floor, it crowds out any other ball movement, any other off-the-ball movement, and it just makes it really difficult to run the kind of offense that D'Antoni wanted to run. I think if the Knicks are going to be at their best, you're going to need to see Carmelo posting up on the block or closer to the block, and you're going to have to see him do some of the team-oriented things that he did on the Olympic team. And I think clearly, you know, this is Melo's time and Melo's team. And with that comes a significant amount of pressure to embrace that and be a team guy as well. And that's something, you know, that I think even he would acknowledge that, you know, has been a struggle for him.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that's the case. I have concerns. You know, you talked about his natural space on the floor limits ball movement, and that's just going to make it hard because, you know, with a lot of these defenses now, not just with the kind of talent that's on them, with the systems that are built in place, I just think you need that ball movement to create open looks, and I think that's going to be somewhere that they're going to struggle with the decisions that they've made. Let's talk real quick before we let you go about the Nets, you know, and obviously they had a huge, monstrous offseason. You know, they had Joe Johnson, traded for Joe Johnson, re-signed Gerald Wallace, re-signed Brook Lopez, and obviously the big key, re-signing Darren Williams. When you look at that roster, do you put that collection of those four guys on the same level? Maybe not with the Heat and Thunder and Lakers now, but do you put them out on the same level of superstar teams like we have in Boston and New York and really with the Clippers even? Do you put them on that level? Are they good enough to be in that kind of level?
You know, I think they could be. You know, clearly their backcourt is about as good as it gets. And for as long as, you know, Joe Johnson is healthy and able to do the things that he can do, that's going to be the case for them. You know, looking 3 years down the road when he's going to be, you know, 34, 35 years old, making almost $30 million, that's a story for another day. But for now, you know, that's a potent backcourt. And, you know, Darren Williams is going to be, you know, an electrifying player to watch because he is, for the first time since he got traded from Utah, he now has a legitimate playoff roster and personnel around him. And I think he's going to be energized by that and rejuvenated by it. A lot of it really, from my standpoint, comes down to Brook Lopez and him staying healthy. I mean, only 5 games last year with the, you know, the 2 foot injuries. That's a real question mark for them. They do have, you know, they were able to add some depth up front, but, you know, they need their big guy to be a part of the offense, a pretty big part of the offense, even though it's going to be perimeter oriented. So I think a lot of that's going to come down to health, and, you know, and it comes down to health of the teams that they're competing against. I mean, you know, clearly the East is different. You know, Boston is going to be different, you know, without Ray Allen. Are they going to be as good? We have to see. Atlanta clearly is not going to be as good. Chicago is going to be without Derrick Rose until, you know, possibly March. So, you know, there's an opening there, and there's a place for the Knicks or the Nets to kind of, you know, assert themselves as a top, you know, 4-6 team in the Eastern Conference. And it's going to make for some interesting discussion. It's going to make for some interesting dynamics here in New York in a couple of months.
Definitely see that coming. Real quick before we let you go, you know, I wrote yesterday about how the Knicks and Nets, you know, the rivalry is being hyped a lot, and I definitely think the fans are into the idea of this inner city, you know, rivalry, but that there's not really a cast of characters on either side that's really bombastic enough. Joe Johnson's not really a public talker. Darren's not really a public talker. Melo even doesn't really run his mouth all that much in the press. So it's hard for me to see where that kind of the stuff that's going to get the real blood going is going to come from. Do you think this is going to develop into the kind of rivalry that maybe everybody in the league especially wants it to be?
I think it really has the potential to. You know, I think it starts with the fact that you have superstars, multiple stars on both of these teams. And I think you're right in that Joe Johnson is not going to be one to stir the pot. But I think Darren Williams, you know, he's not known as the friendliest guy when it comes to the media, but he's also not afraid to speak his mind. So I wouldn't discount him. And I think just the dynamic, you know, there's a really interesting dynamic between Knicks fans and Nets fans. You know, the Knicks fans tend to have this feeling of superiority in this market, that they are the marquee team and they are the flagship franchise. And, you know, it was easy to see why they would feel that way despite all the years of ineptitude. You know, they have a sexier address. I mean, there's been no question about that over the years. But the Nets fan is sitting there going, well, wait a minute, you know, we went to back-to-back finals. You know, we've won more playoff games than the Knicks have over the last decade. You know, what about us? And I think getting them out of the, you know, the doldrums of East Rutherford and then Newark, and now putting them in, you know, not as sexy an address as Manhattan, but, you know, pretty close and pretty unique when it comes to sports, to be in Brooklyn in a new building. And it's going to be fun to see how that plays out. I mean, there are also, remember, there are a lot of Knicks fans in Brooklyn. I mean, you know, there's been no sports team in Brooklyn other than a minor league baseball team, as far as I know, you know, since the Dodgers left. So there's been nobody to root for there if you're a basketball fan other than the Knicks. And now you have an alternative, and it'll be fun to see if there are some turncoats, so to speak, among that part of the fan base.
Great stuff. Thanks so much, Ken. Really appreciate it.
Sure, anytime.
You know, when we look at these things, one thing that's certain is Knicks fans were very upset about the Lynn deal. And I really wanted to get the perspective of Knicks fans and how they felt about that. And to do so, I brought in one of the best bloggers out there to tell us a little bit about how it felt to be on the other end during the Knicks debacle. Okay, join me now on the CBSSports.com NBA podcast is Seth Rosenthal of PostingandToasting.com, New York Magazine, and SBNation.com. Seth, how are you today?
I am terrific. Thanks very much for having me.
Glad that you're here. Seth writes for, like I said, Posting and Toasting, which if you're a Knicks fan, you absolutely have to be reading that site. I've been reading it since I started reading blogs. It is absolutely fantastic. You're not going to find a better combination of wit, analysis, and general mammal-related posts than I think over at PNT. Seth, we're doing this Knicks offseason report, and I wanted to start off by talking about the big elephant in the room. You know, Jeremy Lin, they let him go. I know that you were – I want you to take me through your emotions on that Saturday night when it went from they're definitely going to re-sign him, there's absolutely no question about it, to wait, Raymond Felton says he's coming, to wait, they signed and traded him, to wait, what? Can you just kind of walk me through what you experienced that night?
Oh, man. I mean, that night, that whole, I guess, week was bizarre and sleepless and just – it was torturous, but yeah, I mean, as soon as the union won that appeal or whatever, the court case with the league over Lin and Novak's bird rights, you know, it was clear that the Knicks were going to bring Lin back. It was a foregone conclusion. It was very exciting. And so I'm sure you remember that report started with, I think, a radio guy in South Carolina. I don't even remember how it got to me, but someone said, yo, did you see this? And so here is this thing, this radio reporter with, you know, who's not a basketball guy, with like 100 followers on Twitter, saying, yeah, just talk to Raymond Felton. Raymond Felton says he's getting traded to the Knicks. Oh, and they're getting rid of Jeremy Lin. like it was nothing. And so, you know, most of us saw that and said, there's absolutely no way. No way in hell. And then I think it was Mark Spears came out with, yeah, the Knicks are looking at trading for Jeremy Lin, or trading for Raymond Felton and getting rid of Jeremy Lin. And then it just spiraled into abject terror. and for the, you know, for the days after that, I was up at all hours of the night. And it went back and forth with people saying, you know, maybe they're just trying to scare the Rockets because they're pissed at them. You know, maybe they're signing Felton or they're trading for Felton as sort of a backup to Lin. But you know, as time went on, it became clearer and clearer that the Knicks were actually going to let Jeremy Lin walk. And I guess I shouldn't be surprised by the Knicks anymore, but it was a gut-wrenching surprise. And I'm still sort of reckoning. I mean, I sort of get where it came from now, even though I don't agree with it, but I'm still sort of coming to terms with it. And it's going to take until well into the season to sort of get used to it. And, you know, if he's tearing it up in Houston, that's just going to make it worse.
Yeah, that would be unfortunate on a number of levels. You know, my thing through it was I was just kind of perplexed at the inconsistency where Dolan's never had an issue with paying for the top talent, really overpaying for not top talent. And so for this to finally be a, you know, moment, our own Ken Berger even wrote about how, you know, they made the right decision, even if it's not necessarily consistent or what people want. You know, they did save money, and that was probably, you know, they didn't overpay for Lin, which is a good decision in and of itself. I just feel like if you're going to overpay for somebody, overpay for Lin, who's going to bring in your marketing dollars instead of ratcheting up all the money with the kind of other guys that they've brought in. How much in your mind do you think that the teams kind of build around Carmelo Anthony had to do with this?
I didn't necessarily think that early on, but then going in, when I got to Vegas, when I spoke to people, not like sources, but people who had sources, it really does sound like, you know, Melo, Woodson, Dolan himself, who had some beef with the Rockets about the way they handled business and maybe some beef with Lynn himself. I think, you know, it had a lot to do with the Knicks culture and the direction that they feel like they should be going in, and, you know, who should be the leader of the team and who should be handling, you know, on the court, off the court, just who were the main guys on the team. And somehow Lynn's presence, and then, you know, on top of that, his flirtation with the Rockets and the way, you know, the agents were working, all of that was somehow an affront to the Knicks culture. And I disagree with Berger that it was a smart financial move. I mean, because you said, you know, they're willing to overpay people. And then on top of that, they were overpaying Lynn, but they weren't going to lose any space. You know, they had his bird rights. It was an exception to a capped out team. And in a way, it was their last chance for a while to overpay somebody. It was a loophole. And so I don't think there are valid financial reasons in basketball terms for letting him go. But I do think, you know, the Knicks want to be headed in a certain direction, even if that direction is backwards, which it may be. And I guess they felt that Lynn didn't fit with their sense of what their locker room was going to be like, what their team dynamic was going to be like. And, I mean, you know, that's how they work. It is what it is. You get used to these things as a Knicks fan, but it took a lot of time to understand.
Let's, you know, move on from Lynn a little bit and talk about the rest of the roster, because, you know, there were a lot of things I thought that they did very well. Getting J.R. Smith back at that kind of a discount was huge for them. They didn't give him a lot of years. They didn't give him a lot of money. You know, they brought in Marcus Camby on the cheap. That's going to fill a huge need for them at rebounder. They're no longer relying on really terrible bigs to kind of do the backup work behind Chandler. You know, they've added, I think, good pieces. Even Jason Kidd, I feel like is going to, you know, he's an upgrade over Baron Davis or Mike Bibby. So I feel like that's an area where they improved. If we take the Lynn, you know, condition out of it, we throw in Felton and all the other guys they added, how do you evaluate kind of what they did this offseason outside of the context of the Lynn deal, if that's possible?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, at some points I found myself trying to pretend that Jeremy Lin never existed and that Raymond Felton wasn't included in the original Melo trade. And so now the Knicks are where they are. But yeah, I agree with you. I, you know, I'm not thrilled with their offseason outside of Lin, but I'd say the three big needs were, one, something that's new this year, which is that Iman Shumpert is hurt, and obviously Landry Fields wasn't coming back. So they had a glaring need at shooting guard. And that was going to be a big problem if they didn't find somebody. And, you know, so again, like you said, J.R. Smith coming back relatively cheaply is huge. And then signing Ronnie Brewer for the veterans minimum, which also seems like a steal, is big. So they have a viable shooting guard rotation, despite the fact that their starter left their former starter left and that Shumpert is hurt until, you know, probably 2013. So they filled that need. And then if you look at last year's team, the big problems were when Lynn was hurt or off the court, they had no point guards. And so now that, you know, Felton, we'll see what he has to offer, but he's a decent starting point guard. And then Kidd, again, we'll see what he has to offer, but, you know, he can still pass, he can still run an offense, can still throw, you know, a lob and an entry feed. And then had to have Pablo Prigioni. You know, you have three guys who it wouldn't kill you if they had to start on any given night. They can sustain some injuries in the backcourt and still be all right. And they're deep at that spot. You know, they don't have to turn to Baron Davis and Tony Douglas and force Iman Shumpert to play point guard, force J.R. Smith to play point guard this year. If someone is in foul trouble or gets hurt or something, they're pretty deep. So last season when Chandler was off the floor, they went from being a very good defensive team / mediocre rebounding team to a poor defensive team and like an embarrassingly incompetent rebounding team, like slapping rebounds into the stands and just nonsense. And so now you have Camby, who can still play defense, you know, is still a great weak side shot blocker and whatnot, and has been the most efficient rebounder in the league for the last three seasons. And so when Chandler's off the floor, there's still something that vaguely resembles a basketball team. And that's huge. And, you know, having Kurt Thomas there also, really doesn't hurt. And it's also kind of fun that the starting lineup of the 99 finals team, the starting front court is now the backup front court. They needed a lot of depth help at point guard and at center, and I think they filled those needs. You know, I don't know if Jason Kidd would have been my first choice, but he fits, and, you know, he's a veteran. The guys respect him. And Camby, I think, is great, and I think they overpaid him, but I think the team now, even without Lynn, looks better, and specifically looks better at points of major need than the team did last season.
You know, one thing I do worry about is I feel like they went outside of Felton, who I feel like is going to help out Amari Stoudemire a lot, because they started to get kind of a – they started to click before the trade.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the team very much seems like it was built to – in pursuit of this mellow – what I call the ISO mellow from Mike Woodson. And I just worry about, you know, if he doesn't adjust at all, if he doesn't change his game, are they going to be able to take a step forward? I mean, even with all the additions that they made – you know, if they're all in support of a flawed model, which is give the ball to Melo and watch him do what he does,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe there's going to be – I have a hard time, you know, figuring out if that's going to work. What are your thoughts on that, and are you concerned about that, both with the hire of Mike Woodson and the personnel moves?
Oh, I mean, you got to be concerned about it just because of the way they looked in the playoffs and the way things fell apart. But, I mean, I am, you know, as you know, perpetually an apologist and always looking for excuses. So – I look back at Melo last season and, you know, the way he was playing under D'Antoni, there were undoubtedly long stretches where he was, you know, he was dogging it, he was playing too selfishly, and things like that. But a lot of it was just that the guy was hurt. The guy had a groin injury and a wrist injury for most of the season and just spent a lot of time getting open, playing within the offense, and then missing shots. He just couldn't finish. At the basket, away from the basket, you know, in his office, he just wasn't making shots. And so, you know, the most encouraging thing to me beyond the way he was, you know, playing with in the offense and whatever during the Olympics is that shots were falling. He was hitting jumpers. He was getting to the basket and finishing with contact. And, you know, obviously the guy is going to need to change his game to be like, you know, the superstar leader and all this stuff that people want him to be. But a lot of it last year was just that shots were not going in the basket. And I think that alone could make a huge difference this year if he's just healthy and confident and stepping into his shots. But yeah, I mean, on top of that, he'll probably need to change his game depending a lot on lineups, depending a lot on who's on the floor. You know, the Knicks have a couple shooters. They brought back Novak, which is awesome. J.R. Smith can hit an open three, you know, on odd days. And they have guys like Brewer who can cut off the ball. But I think a lot of it's dependent on lineups. A lot of it is dependent on, you know, how maybe the Olympics have affected his mindset and how Woodson plans to use him, how Woodson plans to use Amari Stoudemire. But I just really think much of the trouble last season boiled down to him missing shots and then that sort of snowballing into him playing a different game or getting grouchy or whatever. So most of all, I just want to be confident that, you know, if the guy's open behind the arc, if he's jab stepping away 18 feet out and he's got the look he wants, that the shot's going to fall more often than not. And that wasn't, you know, that's something that you used to be able to rely on and something that we could rely on in his first half season as a Knick, but something that was very, very streaky, you know, at least until like March of last year when he was healthy.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that's the case. And I think that, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe that'll help him. You know, before I let you go, I want to ask you, I wrote a column this week talking about the Nets and Knicks rivalry that's kind of popping up with the Nets moving to Brooklyn. And there's been this idea that they've been kind of rivals before, but I kind of said that was ridiculous because they've never been really good at the same time. And Knicks fans have never really considered them within really the same kind of context because, you know, they have a whole idea of themselves. But now with the move to Brooklyn, Nets fans especially are kind of, you know, we've heard comments from the mayor of Brooklyn and these kind of things, really making comments that are extreme and trying to rival Steph up and Prokhorov making comments and all these types of things, trying to drum up this thing. I mean, it's clear that the league wants the rivalry. They're scheduling it for opening night. Do you think this is going to develop into a legit rivalry between the two teams?
It might take some time, and it, you know, it's going to rely upon both teams being good, which should be the case this year for the first time in a while. But yeah, I think a rivalry is on its way. I mean, there was a little bit of heat last season, you know, just because Lynn's first really great game was against the Nets, And he torched Darren Williams in that game. And then in the follow-up game, Darren Williams lit Jeremy Lin up like nothing I've ever seen. So there was a little bit of like vindictiveness going back and forth. But obviously Lin's gone, so that part of it is has been washed out. But, at the very least, there is already a rivalry between Knicks fans and Nets fans. And there sort of always has been where, like, Nets fans, you know, since they've been bad are like, well, we're coming for you, you know, all that stuff. And Knicks fans, like, pretend that Nets fans don't exist. You know, like, well, we've never even heard of that team. And so, you know, just on the blogs and stuff, it goes back and forth. There's definitely a little bit of a rivalry. It's completely stupid and inane, but it exists.
like most rivalries are.
Like most rivalries are. And I do think, you know, the league is sort of forcing this to happen by scheduling that on the first night. And I'm sure, you know, there will be at least some Knicks fans in the house at Barclays on the first game. I do think, especially because the team should be good and, you know, project to be good for a couple of years, that'll turn into a rivalry of some sort. Obviously, it's not really a rivalry that anyone outside of the area cares about until, like, they meet in a playoff series or something, or they get in some fights or something. But I could see that happening. But, yeah, I mean, like you said, it hinges on both teams being good at the same time. And that hasn't been the case for quite a while. And this year really feels like the first time in you know, a decade or two where that's going to be the case.
One last question. So, judging everything that you've seen with the Lin acquisition and everything included, can you give me a grade for the Knicks offseason?
A grade. Well, I would give it like something right down the middle, like a nice C or a C+. I think the Lin thing was really just an abject mistake and indefensible and aggravating to no end. And so, you know, that would drop them down to like a D. But then the other stuff they did was mostly sensible. You know, they filled major needs like we talked about. So, you know, that's sort of B+, A-ish stuff. So it bounces out to a nice C, a nice passing grade.
All right, fair enough. That's Seth Rosenthal from postingandtoasting.com and SB Nation, Low New York Magazine. Seth, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Great work. Be sure to check him out. You can also catch him on Twitter at Seth_Rosenthal. Fantastic work. Seth, thanks so much, man.
Thank you.
We heard it from the Knicks' perspective, but you know, the Nets had a huge offseason as well, and to get some perspective on how both sides are kind of going at the same time, we turn to Al Iannazzone of Newsday, an absolutely fantastic writer, and you can follow him on Twitter at Al_Iannazzone on Twitter.
Al, I want to start by asking you your thoughts on what the Knicks' line of thinking was when they decided not to match the offer for Jeremy Lin from the Rockets.
Well, I think it was a money thing. I mean, that's the only way you can, say it right now, especially since the Knicks haven't commented at all since their decision not to match the offer that, you know, was going to pay Jeremy Lin basically $15 million in the third year of its contract. Now, he's worth more off the court. I think everybody knows that. But that final year, he could be, with luxury tax and everything like that, it could be somewhere around $43 million that $15 million becomes. So I think that's the reason they went away from Jeremy Lin, and we'll see if it was a good move or not. I mean, I thought $25 million when the guy only started 25 games in his NBA career was a lot, but, he certainly was a dynamo and a dynamic player those 25 games for the Knicks.
Yeah, obviously Knicks fans, I think, were a little bit were upset about it. It was interesting to see the Knicks, after so many years of being willing to spend the money, for that to kind of selectively be the case where they were concerned about it. Is it one where if they feel like the player has a track record, they're willing to go in on it, and Lin just simply didn't have enough of a track record to justify that kind of expense versus the money that they spent, which was less, but cumulatively they spent a lot on guys like, you know, Jason Kidd and Raymond Felton and, right, and Marcus Camby. They got on pretty good deals, but collectively they spent quite a bit. Adding on to that massive payroll, especially in 3 years when Melo and Amari's contracts kind of go up. Was it thinking mostly based off of, you know, Lin's experience, like you said?
I mean, your guess is as good as mine at this point because, again, the Knicks have not commented to this point on their decision. I do think that plays a part. I mean, look, Jeremy Lin was cut, twice last year before the Knicks picked him up, and he was just about to be cut by the Knicks before he had the game of his life at that point against the Nets. And then, you know, Linsanity took off from there. So, you know, it's a tough call no matter what, because the Knicks clearly have a lot of money. They make a lot of money. Jeremy Lin made them a lot of money. But is it a business decision or is it a basketball decision? I think a little of both. And I think that's what led to it at this point, the $15 million going up to 40-something in luxury tax potentially probably was too much.
You know, last year I think the Knicks had, you know, a lot of issues with depth. They really struggled in terms of when the starters were off. There was just such a huge decline. They've added Marcus Camby. They've added Jason Kidd. They've added Ronnie Brewer, which is kind of an underrated, you know, kind of move. They bring back Steve Novak, but Novak maybe is going to be able to fit into more of a role that he'll be able to be comfortable with and won't be as exposed defensively. Do you think that the adjustments they've made on the bench is going to help them take a huge step forward next year? Is it enough that they've added for them to go forward?
I think they've gotten better. I mean, there's no question about it. I think that, yeah, they got older. That's when you mentioned Marcus Camby, Jason Kidd, Kurt Thomas, Pablo Prigioni. These are guys 35 and older, a couple of them approaching 40. So, you know, that's a good thing from a standpoint of you want veterans, you want experience, you want guys who are playing for something right now. These guys aren't necessarily playing for paychecks. You know, they're playing because they want to win games. Now, did the Knicks do enough to compete with the Miami Heat? No, certainly not. You know, the Heat are far and away a much better team than the Knicks. But I do think that the Knicks are better. You know, like you said, when Tyson Chandler went to the bench last year, the Knicks had no line of defense. And now they have Marcus Camby, who might be a better defender than Tyson Chandler when you think about how much ground he covers. He's more of a shot blocker than Tyson Chandler. You know, Jason Kidd, who I covered many years with the Nets, you know, there are very few players in the NBA more competitive than he is. And he's such a smart player. He's going to find ways to beat you, always has, always will. You know, he can beat you now by hitting the three ball, which he didn't have when he was with the Nets. He's still a pretty good defender. He sees the floor as well as anybody. You know, Kurt Thomas, throughout his career, he's been one of the better perimeter, low post defenders in the league. So Ronnie Brewer, like you said, an underrated pickup, a good defender. You know, and I keep saying defense, defense, defense. That's what the Knicks have always lacked, and we know that. Or at least since, you know, the Oakley-Ewing era, you know, ended. So it's going to be interesting to see how Mike Woodson meshes everybody. You know, the bottom line with the Knicks, though, and I think everybody knows this, how does Carmelo, Anthony, and Amari Stoudemire play together, play off of each other? You know, I think they've improved as a team, but those two need to really play off each other well for the Knicks to take a step in the right direction in terms of, you know, being a top four seed in the Eastern Conference.
You know, switching gears to the Nets, you know, you broke a huge story over the summer when, you know, you spoke with Deron Williams and he told you how much of an impact Joe Johnson, the acquisition of Joe Johnson by the Nets, had on him re-signing there. You know, what do you think it is that drove him that really made it to where Johnson was the kind of player that Williams wanted to play with?
Well, he wouldn't have to do as much. And I think that's the way Deron Williams is. I mean, he's a facilitator. He's a point guard. We know that. You know, sometimes he's going to score. Like he had a great game last. I think he had 50 something points last year. But he's a point guard and he doesn't want to be the center of attention. And he wants guys around him who he can make better. And that's what Joe Johnson is. I mean, Joe Johnson's a proven all-star in this league. And I do believe if they didn't get Joe Johnson, he would be, you know, Deron Williams would be a Dallas Maverick right now. And it's very interesting how it played out. I mean, Billy King completed the deal for Joe Johnson right before he was getting ready to sit down with Deron Williams and have his, you know, one-on-one, or not one-on-one, have his meeting with Deron Williams during free agency. So that was a big, big factor. I mean, the Nets did everything they could to get Dwight Howard. Obviously, it just didn't happen. You know, Deron knew that. He knew everything they were trying. But still, he was close to leaving, and that Joe Johnson deal proved to be huge. And I think the Nets have improved, obviously. You get a guy like Joe Johnson, if Brook Lopez is healthy, you know, you have pieces there now, and you still have Deron Williams. So they're opening Brooklyn, you know, with a better team than they closed New Jersey with.
when you look at kind of the rivalry that's building there, I mean, I think for years it's been Knicks fans have largely ignored the Nets because they were in New Jersey. And now Nets fans, I mean, there's been a lot of talk from the Nets and from even politicians in Brooklyn talking about, you know, how they're going to compete with the Knicks and how they're going to take over as the, you know, top basketball team in New York, which is hard to imagine just because of the massive Knicks fan base. You know, how much do you think that ownership kind of plays into this? Because Provorov seems to be the type where he likes to kind of prod a little bit. They've done a lot of things, including putting up billboards during the 2010 free agency. Right. You know, they've made a lot of comments, especially we're trying to capitalize when Lynn left, on telling Knicks fans they can defect and be Nets fans. Do you think there's going to be a commitment to try and build this rivalry between the two franchises, or do you think the Knicks are going to continue to try and probably ignore the Nets as another basketball entity in New York?
I think the Knicks will still try to be the Knicks. I mean, we look at the situation here, and I've always likened it to the Lakers and the Clippers. I think most people do that too. You know, the Lakers are the more established team than the Clippers, and the Clippers are on the rise with the Chris Paul and you know, Blake Griffin. But now look what happens with the Lakers. They still have Kobe. They go out and get Steve Nash. And now they have Dwight Howard. So that's going to be LA's team for a long time. The Nets and Knicks, it's a different story. I mean, the Nets have played in New Jersey all those years. Even when they were good, even when they were going to the finals with Jason Kidd, they weren't selling out. You know, I think that's the reason they ultimately moved to Brooklyn, because they weren't getting the fan base here. And it's going to be tough. I mean, I think everybody can't wait to see opening night when you have the Knicks and Nets at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. Because I've been to so many Nets-Knicks games in New Jersey, and every time, you know, I would say 60% or better were Knicks fans. What's it going to be like in Brooklyn? I don't know, but I still think it's going to take a lot to convert Knicks fans into Nets fans. I mean, if you're a true fan, you don't change your team, you know, but it happens. You know, guys change teams all the time. Fans change teams all the time. The bottom line is you have to be good. And right now, I don't know who's better. You know, I'm going to say the Knicks are better because they've been to the playoffs the last 2 years. But the Nets now have better players in terms of, you know, Joe Johnson. They made some moves this offseason, bringing in some good guys. So it is going to be an interesting rivalry, and we just have to see how it plays out. I mean, I don't think the two have been good at the same time since like 1993 or 94, whatever it was. So it'll be interesting.
Fantastic. Great stuff. As always, make sure to check out Al's work at Newsday and follow him on Twitter. An absolute must follow for any Knicks fan. Just does great stuff all across the board every single day. Al, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Matt. Take care.
All right, this is going to end part one of our Knicks-Nets offseason review podcast. Part two will be up real shortly. We got Howard Beck of the New York Times and Devin Karpentian over at NetsAreScorching.com. It's going to be really great. We'll continue this discussion about both sides and kind of what both teams did and the thinking thereof. So be sure to check that out. Until then, make sure to like us on Facebook. You can check us out on iTunes. Subscribe to us. Follow us on Twitter at IonBasketball. And